And welcome to Juno Afternoon on Monday, December 29th, 2014. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, we'll hear from Solid Waste Management Coordinator Jim Panor about Christmas tree recycling. Rosemary Welling will be here to give us an update on programs at the Marie Drake Planetarium. And we'll listen to a special program, the Fairbanks version of Mudrooms, called Dark Winter Nights. Those interviews, special programs, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more right here on a Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. This year's White House Tribal Nations Conference had much focus on Native youth. Tribal leaders say education is part of investing in young people. Matt Laszlo reports.
It's been 4 years since the National Congress of American Indians resolved that U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan should create an Assistant Secretary of Indian Education position. Native leaders are still echoing that call. Aaron Payment tells Duncan that a new secretary position shouldn't mean the end of the Interior Department's Bureau of Indian Education.
But if we're ever going to face the 90% of our kids that are educated in the public education system, we need to transcend any individual president and start the path in the president's legacy on education and create the Assistant Secretary for Indian Education.
Marshall Grover, president of the Pawnee Nation of Oklahoma, spoke to Duncan after Payment. Grover says Native youth would be more likely to stay in public schools if the institutions spoke to their history.
And one of the things Aaron mentioned was the second secretary for education, specifically for Native Americans, so that we make sure that when our children go to school on Columbus Day, they're not reading about some guy that was lost. I mean, some guy that said he claimed this country.
Duncan is leery, cautioning Grover about what the secretary says are the limits of federal power.
You know, so I'll think about it. I have a fair amount of skepticism, again, of our ability to solve all these things from Washington. I get the idea of institutionalizing that role. Let me just be really, really clear on the curriculum side. So we are prohibited by law from touching curriculum. So curriculum, textbooks, all those things, we in Washington cannot do that.
U.S. education curricula are becoming more uniform, but not because of the federal government. It's because the governors of 44 states have adopted the Common Core standards. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Legal scholar and advocate Sarah Deer was among a group of people to receive a 2014 MacArthur Award, also known as Genius Grants. Fellows receive a more than $600,000 stipend. Polly Dinetclaw recently spoke with Deer about her work.
Can you tell me more about your work around the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act?
So I had an opportunity to testify in front of the Senate committee at some point along the way about sex trafficking and including that language in the reauthorization bill. Another opportunity that I had was to write a letter to Congress signed by 50 law professors that was designed to address some of the myths about the restoration of inherent tribal authority.
Sarah, can you tell me about why your advocacy work centers around protecting Native women against violence?
Well, to me, I am an advocate for tribal self-determination and tribal sovereignty. And I think that women, Native women, are the centerpiece of tribal sovereignty and self-determination. And if Native women are experiencing high rates of trauma and violence, it makes it very difficult for the tribe to govern itself because you have so many people in pain. And so violence against women, to me, is a central issue for any efforts to advance tribal nation self-determination.
As a MacArthur Genius grantee, what do you hope to do?
I would like to continue to work on research and scholarship related to violence against Native women. I'm interested in potentially working on a book or a documentary that would raise even more awareness about how Native women survive and how we can further improve the system to be responsive to Native women who are victimized.
That was Polly Dinetclaw talking with MacArthur Fellow Sarah Deer. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's about 6 minutes after the hour, and you're listening to a Juneau Afternoon here in the capital city of Alaska, Juneau. Scott Burton, your host here on a Juneau Afternoon, and with me now in the studio is Rosemary Welling and Steve Kosas. Welcome, you two.
Hi, Scott.
Hi,
this
Scott.
Is Steve.
Thanks for coming down today, you two. So we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on at the Marie Drake Planetarium. Who wants to start?
Oh, hi, this is Steve, and Marie Drake Planetarium has been around Juneau 40-some years, and we have a great talk tomorrow, Tuesday, last Tuesday of the month, 6:30 p.m., Rosemary Walling is giving it, on the Rosetta Mission, which is the scientific breakthrough of the year.
Tell us about it, Rosemary.
So the Rosetta Mission is a mission that started a long time ago. It was launched in 2004, and this year it finally reached its destination, which is the comet, which we could nickname as 67P, CG, Cheru, Jera, but it has a name that's two Russian names, Cherumov and Gerasimenko. But most of the time we just abbreviated it something. And so it's been a really exciting mission. In order to get there, it had to do several things. It had to fly by Earth and gained some momentum, had to go by Mars, went by Earth a couple of more times, and it flew by two asteroids, so it's already had one scientific mission. And then it had to go into hibernation because this comet wasn't really the one that was planned, and this one's further away. So it went into hibernation for a while from 2011 to 2014. And so one really exciting time was, would it wake up? And then another exciting time was once it got to the comet and started its mission there.
Does sound very interesting. Rosemary, what's your background? How did you get involved with the planetarium, and how did you get interested with 67P and Rosetta?
So my background's really physics, and I did research for quite a while before I moved to Alaska. And then when I moved here, I started teaching, and one of the courses I taught was astronomy. And so sort of the physics and astronomy has always been of interest to me. And so once I started teaching, I got even more interested in it.
Okay. And will you tell us, give our listeners sort of a visual about 67P, how big it is, how fast it's going, stuff like that, and tell us a little bit about what Rosetta's like.
So the comet is a few kilometers with an average diameter, but the shape is very unusual. It wasn't what they expected. If you look at it from one perspective, it really looks kind of like a rubber duck. It almost looks like two pieces of a comet that people aren't quite sure right now whether it's two pieces that came together or whether it's one piece that got carved by every time it goes near the sun, it kind of explodes in various ways. And it's going, now it's about 3.5 astronomical units from the sun, so it's moving pretty fast. That's 3.5 times the distance of the Earth to the sun. And then when it gets closest to the sun, it's going to be a little bit farther away from the sun than the Earth is right now. And it rotates with a period of about 12.5 hours. And the Rosetta spacecraft is moving very slowly relative to the comet. Right now it's in an orbit, which is really hard to do because there's not much gravity there. Before it started its gravitational orbit, it did some triangular kind of routes around it. And again, at some point it'll stop from being a sort of a orbit as we think of, and it will rely a lot on its thrusters to move it back and forth and go into different geometries close to the comet and away from it.
Okay. And so you're going to be talking about all of this in more detail, probably showing some images and such on tomorrow night at 6:30. Is that right?
That's right. There's a lot of interesting science results. One of the first results has to do with this question of where did the Earth's water come from, whether it came from comets, asteroids, whether it's always been on the Earth. And so one of the first measurements that they've announced from the Rosetta mission tries to address that question. So okay. We'll talk about that some more.
Interesting. And for folks that don't know where the planetarium is, can you describe its location?
Steve probably can do that better.
Okay. It's on Glacier Avenue between the high school and the Harborview School. So it's right behind that artificial turf field with the 10-foot-high fence around it.
All right. And, Steve, what's your relationship with the planetarium?
Well, I'm an amateur astronomer since I was a teenager. I like to stargaze and go to total solar eclipses, and I've been giving talks at the planetarium here for about 10 years.
Okay. And I think there's some other programs going on, right?
Yeah, after Rosemary's talk, we're going to do the stars tonight on the Spitz projector, which is now... It's 48 years old, and made in Pennsylvania, Spitz A4P, USA-made projector, analog, not digital, and it's still working. So
cool.
We'll use that after Rosemary's talk. And we're having some future talks. Our public shows are last Tuesday of the month, and next month, last Tuesday of the month, will be January 27th, and there'll be a talk on astrophysics, probably dark energy, dark matter. Some topic of astrophysics. And then in February 20th and 21st, we're having a visiting astronomer, Dennis Mamana from San Diego. He's going to give two public talks, 7 p.m., February 20th and February 21st.
All
those
right.
Are future shows.
Sounds good. I suspect this is all on MurrayDrakePlanetarium.org.
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. That's our website, has all our scheduled events. And the planetarium here in Juneau is the largest planetarium dome in the state, and also Washington State. It's larger than the Pacific Science Center in Seattle. Yeah, our planetarium dome is larger than the Pacific Science Center in Seattle.
Here in Juneau. All right, and what's the cost for Tuesday's program?
Tomorrow's program is free, or public shows are free, and they're hopefully all ages are welcome, and we try to have the shows mainstream. So, Rosemary, you can have any mathematical notation? and let me just say, the imagery from Rosetta, I think, is the most exciting space images I've seen for quite a while.
Yeah, there's a lot of drama there, too. There's some neat images. There's what happened to the lander when it went down, came back up, went down again. So at the show, we'll be able to show a lot of that.
I'm still stuck on the part where this comet is going thousands of miles per hour through space, and we are able to link up with it and get in orbit. I mean, isn't it going something like 84,000 miles per hour or something like that? That doesn't even seem possible to me.
I would say it's at least that much.
That's all classical mechanics. We just use Newton's laws.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of nudge up to it at the same speed. So relative, it's moving like... centimeters per second relative to it, but the whole thing's moving really fast.
Wow. I mean, I did just see Interstellar, but this is real, right?
It's the first time we've landed, I mean, not landed, but, well, also landed, but gone into orbit around something that's this light.
Wow.
Has so little gravity.
Yeah, interesting. A lot to learn tomorrow, 6:30 at the planetarium. Rosemary Welling and Steve Kosas. Anything else you two would like to add?
Well, it's just that the planetarium is available for any school groups. Just contact the website, MurrayDrakePlanetarium.org, and we can set up shows for school groups.
Oh, that sounds great. All right, thanks a lot, you two.
Thank you, Scott.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 29th of December, 2014. It's the anniversary of the massacre at Wounded Knee, South Dakota, 1890. 23 years after the local tribes had signed a treaty with the U.S. government guaranteeing them the rights to the land around the Black Hills, sacred land to the Indians. The treaty said that no one could move there, no one could even travel through there, without the consent of the tribes. But in the 1870s, gold discovered in the Black Hills, the treaty was broken. People from the Sioux tribe were forced onto a reservation. There was a promise of more food and supplies, which never came. And then in 1889, a native prophet named Wovoka from the Paiute tribe in Nevada had a vision of a ceremony that would renew the earth and return the buffalo and make the white men disappear. It was called the Ghost Dance, and people traveled across the plains to hear Wovoka speak, including emissaries from the Sioux tribe who brought his teachings back to South Dakota. The Ghost Dance, performed in brightly colored shirts, spread through the villages on the Sioux reservation. It frightened the white Indian agents. It seemed dangerous to them. One of them wired Washington to say he was afraid, he wanted to arrest the leaders. He was given permission to do that, to arrest Chief Sitting Bull, who was killed in the attempt. And the next chief on the wanted list was Sitting Bull's half-brother, Chief Bigfoot, who, when he found out about it, decided to lead his people to Pine Ridge Reservation for protection. But it was winter. It was 40 below zero. He contracted pneumonia on the way. He was sick. He was flying a white flag. He was a peaceful man. He had actually renounced the idea of the Ghost Dance. But the Army did not make distinctions. They intercepted Bigfoot's band, ordered them into the camp on the banks of the Wounded Knee Creek. Bigfoot went peacefully. The next morning, federal soldiers began confiscating their weapons. A scuffle broke out between a soldier and an Indian. The soldiers opened fire, killing almost 300 men, women, and children. One of the people wounded was the famous medicine man Black Elk, who said, "I did not know then how much was ended. I can still see the butchered women and children lying heaped and scattered all along the Crooked Gulch, and I can see that something else died there and was buried in the blizzard. A people's dream died there. It was a beautiful dream." Here's a poem for today by Philip Dacey, guest of honor. "Every day I drive by the grave of my fiancée's father. She lost him when she was one. He's our intimate stranger, our guardian angel floating a la Chagall just above our heads. I go to him for love lessons. He touches my hand with that tenderness the dead have for the living. When I touch her hand so, she knows where I've been. At the wedding, he'll give her away to me, and the glass he'll raise to toast us will be a chalice brimful of sun, his words heard all the more clearly for their absence, as stone is cut away to form dates." A poem by Philip Dacey, guest of honor from Church of the Adagio, published by Rain Mountain Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute FIT test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. Learn more at lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
This New Year's Eve, head to the Jack when Juno Jazz and Classics proudly presents Swing in the New Year. Put on your dancing shoes and party the night away to the sounds of the Thunder Mountain Big Band with the Miss St. Behaven Trio. Enjoy complimentary hors d'oeuvres and a champagne toast at midnight. Tickets and more information at jazzandclassics.org, the Jack, Hearthside Books, and at the door. Get ready to swing in the new year, a benefit for the Juno Jazz and Classics 2015 Festival.
It's about 24 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, December 29th, 2014. Scott Burton, your host. And now with me in the studio is Jim Pinor. He's the Solid Waste Management Coordinator for CBJ. Welcome, Jim.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Scott.
It's great to have you. So tell us, what does a Solid Waste Management Coordinator do?
Well, it's a Solid Waste Coordinator for CBJ. Basically, I take care of any questions that come from the citizens as far as how they handle their waste. I help businesses. I've give presentations, and I've also helped set up recycling programs. We have the recycling contract with Capital Landfill at the landfill, and I also run by contract the hazardous waste drop-off facility that's now open weekly.
Okay. Let's just start with Christmas tree recycling, and then we'll take it from there. How can folks get their Christmas trees to you?
Okay, we'll start it January 2nd. It will run for 1 month through January 31st. It's located, same location, Capital Landfill. CBJ and Capital Landfill put this program on. The trees can be dropped off for free. Just so everybody knows that on New Year's Eve, the landfill will be closing at noon. So I want to make sure everybody's aware of that. Friday, they'll be closed New Year's Day. Friday, they'll reopen. They'll be open Friday from 7:30 to 5, and then Saturday, 8 to 5. And you can start recycling your trees on the 2nd.
Okay. Let's see. Aside from that, Jim, you were saying that you give presentations on letting folks know what you do as solid waste management as the department. And speaking of that, I'm also holding this magazine in front of me called Waste Advantage, and the advantage in the waste and recycle industry is the subtitle, and there is the City of Juneau on the front cover of this magazine. The City of Juneau, AK's Waste Management Department, staying ahead of the game.
We actually got pretty lucky on that one to get the front cover. I had attended a waste convention in Dallas this last year.
Mm-hmm.
It was in a suburb of Dallas, and while I was there, I happened to have dinner with the publishing editor for Waste Advantage, and we started working on doing a spotlight for Juneau. I thought it was pretty unique.
Cool. So how are we ahead of the game?
Actually, we're ahead of the game as far as our population base and what we're actually recycling per tons per year. I still want to expand on that, but it talks about the difficulties that we run across with recycling here in Southeast and Juneau specifically as far as trying to get our recycled material to market, how we handle our hazardous waste, and the things like that. It's difficult. We're on an island. We're
right.
Very similar to like Hawaii and other places that you have to be pretty innovative to make it happen.
Sure. What are some of the parts that you're most proud of our program here?
I think I've been here 5 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the one thing I'm most proud of right now is the household hazardous waste. It was 7 events a year. I think the citizens can remember that. Out there on Commercial Boulevard going towards Costco, we would have to close down streets and circle around and bring the citizens into a one-day event per month in the spring months. Always had a line of traffic. We were consistently 500 cars plus. And I have now changed that to open Friday and Saturday for residents and Thursday for businesses weekly, and there is no more lines. That also gives us an opportunity to better handle the drop-off material, and we have an exchange program now that's called Has-Been. Very successful. We're actually exchanging back out into the community 500 to 600 pounds of dropped off material that's still usable instead of shipping that south, having the cost and expense of shipping it plus disposal. We're now trying to utilize that within the community for what it was manufactured for.
Interesting. So local recycling or local reuse?
Local reuse.
What's an example of a has-been product that can go back out?
There's a picture there on page 20 in the article. Just about anything that comes in that's still half full, the container isn't leaking, could be paint, could be antifreeze, could be pesticides, cleaners, you know, anything that you have in your household, basically that you buy at retail that has hazardous or danger on it, should be taken to the household hazardous waste facility. It's lacquers, thinners, brake fluid, antifreeze. You can see the shelves there. They're in the magazine there somewhere.
Yeah.
We're very successful. As a matter of fact, I'm expanding the program. Just bought a 20-foot intermodal container, CBJ-owned now, and I'm going to put shelves in it, and the citizens are going to be able to go in there, and they'll all be on shelves, be set up a little bit better. I didn't realize we would be doing 500 to 600 pounds per week exchange.
Wow. Excellent, excellent. What would you say is your biggest challenge? This sounds like a great success. What's one of your biggest challenges?
Right now, I'm still manicuring out the hazardous waste, trying to now better go through and better locally recycle the material coming in. We did in FY13 right around 21,000 gallons of paint, and I bought a paint can crushing machine that now we put it in 55-gallon drums and are solidifying it hard and going to landfill it.
Okay.
Way better than paying for the cost to ship it out, and we're going to have a substantial savings there. Down the road a little bit, I hope to try out a paint exchange program. So if somebody comes to me and says, hey, I'm not quite ready to do that yet, but I am going to work on it and do a pilot paint giveaway program. Okay. Just things like that. Our oil no longer, the waste oil out of automobiles and boats and stuff that gets brought to us, we no longer ship out. It goes to Delta now. The fluorescent bulbs that come in fluorescent, we have a bulb crushing machine, takes the mercury and the gases out of it. We now crush that into drums, and it's landfillable, according to EPA. Now we can take that, the gas and the hazard's been removed, and we're not shipping that out, and I'm pretty proud of that.
Okay. And you're the guy, it sounds like. If somebody has questions or concerns about how we recycle, it sounds like you're the person to talk to.
Most definitely.
And if somebody wants to get a hold of you, what's the best way to do that?
Call me at CBJ at my office at 780-6009. Be glad to help you out. I'd like to back up a second on the Christmas trees.
Sure.
Briefly, real quick, to keep this program successful for the Christmas trees have to be absolutely clean. No lights, no tinsel, no flock. And as long as we can keep the Christmas trees coming in for the recycle program clean, because it's all volunteer for the most part in cost. We're trying to keep the cost down. Mm-hmm. And so as long as the trees come in clean, we can keep the program going. Last year, we had a pretty large percent of contaminated trees, and it just added to the problem, and I hope that doesn't continue. I just wanted to bring that up.
Oh, yeah, good point. And again, that starts January 2nd.
January 2nd.
All the way, pretty much the entire month of January, you can take your clean Christmas trees.
Yep.
Down to solid waste management.
Down to the Capitol Landfill on Tongsgood Boulevard, and we'll pile them up there till it's over. And then we take and we come in with a city street crew and a CBJ chipper, and we chip them all up. And then them chips, when we do get it done, it's the street department doing the job. They come over, they've been coming in volunteering and doing that for us. And that's a great program. The only thing is depending on the weather and the roads, if they're out, you know, pushing snow on the roads and we have bad weather, I have to wait.
Sure.
But other than that, it's an excellent program. And there's quite a few happy people that take them chips away for free.
All right, Jim. Well, thanks for your hard work. Anything else we're missing here? Anything you want to add?
No, I would urge anybody that would like to read about the solid waste more, pull up wasteadvantage.com and go to the December issue of the magazine. And right there on your computer, you can flip through the pages and read it. I believe it's a great thing for Juneau. The Waste Advantage has about 60,000 subscribers, so that really got Juneau out on the map, I think.
All right, Jim, thanks for your time.
Okay, thank you for having me, Scott.
reminder to Capital Transit and Caravan passengers. Buses and vans will not be operating on Thursday, January 1st in recognition of the New Year's holiday. Full service will resume on Friday, January 2nd. The drivers and staff at Capital Transit and Caravan wish everyone a happy and safe New Year.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, December 29th. It's about 37 minutes after 3. We're going to listen to a special program next, and it's been described as the Fairbanks version of Mudrooms, and it's called Dark Winter Nights with host Rob Prince. You can find him on the internet, Dark Winter Nights in Fairbanks. Let's give a listen.
This
How about right
is
after Bird,
Bird
Note.
Note? Many people think that evolutionary change occurs so slowly we cannot observe it directly. Not so. For example, today in the U.S., house finches are evolving rapidly and visibly. In 1941, some captive house finches from California escaped near New York City. They spread rapidly and are now found across most of the United States and in southern Canada. Many of these areas have cold, snowy winters, during which many birds die. The finches have evolved because those that survive differ from their parents. Size is one example. Male house finches in recently established populations in Michigan and Montana are larger than the males that escaped. Large males outcompete small males for food, so are more likely to survive the winter. They also pair more successfully with females early in the spring. Smaller females survive better than larger females as nestlings. Also, because they need less food to maintain their own bodies, they can breed earlier in spring. Females that breed earlier raise more young than those that start breeding later. Rapid evolution of house finches reminds us that evolutionary changes are occurring visibly all around us. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
And here are some selections from the Fairbanks version of Mudrooms called Dark Winter Nights with host Rob Prince.
It's tough when Hollywood calls. You kind of don't know what to do at first. Your instinct is to give them whatever they want. It's like the most popular girl in high school calling you up out of the blue. Whatever she's calling about, you're gonna help. The first time Hollywood called me, they were looking for a reality TV show subject up here in Fairbanks, Alaska. I was pretty pumped and did a lot of hunting trying to find them a good person to do a reality TV show on. But they didn't like anyone I found them, which of course added to my sense of unworthiness. The next time Hollywood called, they wanted help finding someone who lived in a dry cabin. You see, we've got these cabins up here that don't have any running water, and they're pretty novel to folks in the lower 48. This was one of those house hunter type shows, and they wanted to take someone who already lived in a dry cabin, have them pretend to go dry cabin hunting for the cameras, and then pick the one they already lived in. Man, I worked hard to find them somebody. I sent them all sorts of names, but do you know what happened? They did the show, used one of the people I sent them, but never thanked me or even told me when they were coming up to shoot. Man, did I feel used. And so that's when I decided I wasn't going to do this anymore. I was no longer going to be the northern yokel who dropped everything every time there was a Hollywood area code on my caller ID. I figured, if people wanted to hear stories about Alaska, then it should be Alaskans who are sharing those stories. And so that's what you're getting right now. This is the pilot episode of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska. All the storytellers you're going to hear are Alaskans telling stories that happened right here in Alaska, and I'm proud to bring them to you. In this episode, I picked out three of my favorite stories from our first ever Dark Winter Nights live storytelling event at the Pioneer Park Civic Center Theater. Up first is one of the funniest and most genuine people I know. Ladies and gentlemen, Melissa Buchto.
Okay, so let me just start by saying I love Alaska. I do. I really do. I've loved growing up here. I love living here. But it can be really difficult living here for someone who is partially blind, like myself. So a little bit about myself. I am what is considered legally blind, so I'm not sighted enough for the sighted people, but I'm not blind enough for the blind people either. I walk this really weird line of this just really weird gray area, just is kind of where I'm living. And when you're growing up here in this state, you know, your parents probably own a motorhome or a camper or a big van or a car or something, and you do what everybody does. You go on road trips. But, you know, you're mostly, when you're in Alaska, you go on a road trip to see the wildlife, to see the scenery, because it's awesome. A lot of that is lost on someone who can't see. Did you know that blind people get in national parks for free? That's really great. Think about that for a second. Because really, what's a blind person going to do in a national park? I mean, everyone's like, oh, look, McKinley is so beautiful. Look at Denali. It's great. I can't touch Denali. Denali's not going to say something. I can't go like, you know, hey, Denali, how's it going?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
That's not going to happen. I can't go to Yellowstone and touch Old Faithful either. I can't really get very close to Old Faithful. I can hear it, so I guess that's pretty cool. I've never been to the Grand Canyon either, but I'm pretty sure that would also be lost on me. It's deep. Yay! Fantastic! Can we go eat some tacos? And we'd go on these road trips, and we'd bring our binoculars and everything, and we'd go, my parents loved going down to Seward, because it was so lush and beautiful, and it was close, much closer than Denali. And they'd go, oh, look at the eagles, look at the dull sheep sitting up there on the mountains, oh, they're so beautiful. And we'd pull off to these overlooks, you know, to see the belugas and everything, and my mom would put these giant binoculars up to my face and try in vain to point my head in the direction that she thought the wildlife was. So we're sitting here, you know, she's like, look, it's over here. And my dad and my brother just basically out of sheer embarrassment and or pity would just kind of sidestep away. We don't know these people. And people would come up and tap my dad on the shoulder and go, you know, do you know that woman? It looks like she's abusing her child. So I decided, because I was sick and tired of having my neck wrenched around by my mother, and I was sick and tired of my parents being so darn disappointed that I couldn't see anything because they were like, we're not fulfilling your life, we're not giving you a good time. And I really, really wanted them to know that I appreciated all that they were doing and then this experience and everything. So I decided to lie to my parents. I just figured, why not? I'm just going to, everybody will be happy. So whenever we would see an eagle or a dull sheep or a bear, I'd put my binoculars up to my face and go, wow, that's amazing. It's so cool. And I couldn't really be that specific because, you know, I couldn't be like, oh, look at it reach into the stump and just like, but that's a boulder. Right, but the bear. So what I would do is I would pretend to see all these things, and I'd have like stock footage from the Discovery Channel going in my head. Because, you know, I know what a bear looks like. So, yeah. Oh, one day we went and took our annual summer road trip. We ended up in Seward, Alaska. It's a little harbor town for those of you who might not have been. It's where all the wildlife boats and cruises go out of and everything. So we got on this boat and we're all excited and I'm super excited. I want to see a whale, you know. I want to see an orca. I love orca whales. I think they're beautiful creatures and I think they're amazing. And that's what I wanted to see when we got on this boat. And of course, we get on the boat, you know, 2 hours later, just doing our thing. We've seen seals and puffins and we saw a bear even, and we saw dolphins. It was great. It was a really great day. We were lucky to get to see all this wildlife. And of course, we saw glaciers and beautiful scenery, which is easy for me to see because glaciers don't move very fast. And they make noise sometimes, which is nice. Very nice. Glacier, the most accessible of the Alaskan scenery if you're blind. So we're going along in the this boat, and we're doing our thing, and I decided instead of feeling upset and down about seeing all these animals, I would just learn to experience and have fun on this cruise in my own way. So I'd stand on the bow of the boat, and I would hold on to the boat railings and feel the perspiration and the cold water of the metal on my hands. And I felt the boat going up and down and up and down and rocking from side to side. So I would enjoy that feeling. I'd look at the rock formations as they would drift in and out of the mist as we would go past them. I let the wind go through my hair. It was beautiful. And I was really, really enjoying myself. And I thought, you know, even if I don't see a whale, I've had an incredible day. Well, we were about to go back to the harbor, and we pulled off into this cove because the captain had got a radio call from another ship that there was a pod of orcas in this cove. And so we pull up into this cove, and everybody is real quiet, you know, and the captain's like, okay, if we see whales, don't scream and point, because you'll just scare them away, you know. And so everyone's out of the cabins on the boat, and we're all on the railings, and this was like a triple-decker boat. It was a big boat, so all three decks full of people. And we see them. There are this pod of orca whales, and they're just hanging out in this cove. And they kind of disappear under the water, and the captain pulls up, and he shuts the boat engine off. We're all really, really quiet. And the whales decide to swim over towards our boat. So we're all looking at these whales. And we're all just waiting. You know, we don't know what's going to happen. I'm standing there. I got my binoculars. And I'm just thinking about whales, you know, in my head. I just saw Free Willy. So putting those images in there, you know, just getting ready for another yay. But the whales surrounded our boat, and right in front of me comes this dorsal fin. This beautiful, black, proud dorsal fin comes slowly up out of the water, right, you know, right in front of me, probably about to the end of this stage, you know, and I can see about 3 feet in front of me before everything starts to get really blurry. So this whale comes up, and I can see it's right in front of me. I can see the white marks above the whale's eyes, and I can see the white marks from the belly that kind of come up on the back. I can see the whale's tail, and I just stood there. I was holding on to the railing so tight, my knuckles were turning white, and I was just so afraid that if I moved or did anything or second-guessed myself, that the whale would just disappear. But the whale didn't. We just kind of stood there in each other's space, just sensing each other and looking at each other. And I can just remember thinking to myself, wow, finally, I'm here. We're here together. And I looked at the whale and I whispered so that no one else could hear, thank you. Thank you for letting me be here with you. Thank you for letting me see you. I didn't even have to use my binoculars. I was so happy. And I knew that when we got back to the docks, I wasn't going to have to lie to my parents this time about seeing something that I really, really, really wanted to see. Now, granted, the next day I went back to lying to my parents. And I still lie to my parents to this day, actually, about seeing wildlife. We've just kind of come to accept it. It's our thing. Thank you.
I'll be honest, I'm not a big fan of camping. I don't sleep well, it always seems like it's raining, and I hate the midnight treks to the outhouse. Our next storyteller isn't a fan of camping either, but he's got a much better reason for it. Ladies and gentlemen, James Meniker.
Well, I was bummed. My whole family was bummed, actually. It was 1984. I was 10 years old. I had two younger brothers. One was 9, one was 5. And my dad had just bought a piece of property out off of 26 Mile Tuna Hot Springs Road. And he was going to take us out there on a nice long weekend to explore the property. And we had been planning this for a month or so. And the week leading up to it, it rained nonstop. And we were all just feeling bummed. My mom especially, because she lived in a house full of 4 guys, and she was really excited about being able to have a nice, long, quiet weekend. The Thursday before we were going to leave, the rain stopped and the skies cleared, and my dad said, "It is game on. We are going tomorrow." We were so excited because we were confident that the rain would not bother us anymore on this trip. And then. So we load up into the truck, my dad's old red and white Dodge pickup truck that he had driven for 15 years. We load the canoe on top of it. We load it up with supplies and camping gear and everything you need for a long weekend of hiking and exploring. We put my dad in the driver's seat, and the 3 of us get into the cab, and off we go. And my mom is waving, smiling, tears of joy coming down her face as she has a pile of books that will not be interrupted. So as we drive out to Chino Hot Springs Road, we find our turnoff, and we go down this winding, gravelly, bumpy road, the kind they still have there, and we come down to the river, and we're like, this looks like a great place to set up camp. The river's, I won't lie, the river's high. It's swollen, but it looks like we'll set up our camp for the evening, and then we'll go across tomorrow. It'll be great. So we get our camp set up round about 4:35 in the afternoon, and we notice the river's higher than it used to be. Well, okay, so we'll move farther up the road. That's not a problem. By the time we get our camp taken down, the river is noticeably higher, so we move substantially farther up the road and get the tent up and get the fire going. And it keeps following us, this river. We decide maybe we should find another camping spot. And so as we're taking down the tent, by the time we get camp taken down the second time and loaded into the truck, the fire has been put out by the river. Haste might be required here. So, again, we load everything up into the truck. Dad gets in and drives. The 3 of us load into the cab. And we start driving up the road to get back on the Chino Hot Springs Road, go find a better camping spot. We come around a bend, and we see that ahead of us, the river has jumped its banks and is coming down the road at us. My dad sits there idling for a moment, wondering what he should do. He decides chains will probably be the best solution, because chains really help in driving up river. And so he gets out and he puts on the chains, muttering to himself. We 3 are sitting in there like, this is not what we were expecting to see. So as Dad gets all chained up, he's like, okay, boys, here we go. We start driving up the road. Pretty soon we're driving up the river. The water's coming up, and he tells my brother, John, who's the 9-year-old, sitting closest to the window, okay, son, I want you to climb out the window and sit on the cab. And when debris comes down river at us, I want you to push it out of the way. So here's my brother, John, kicking his feet on the truck, pushing out sticks and making sure that nothing torpedoes us. And we're going. We're driving up river. Finally, we start to float. My dad realizes the chains may not be able to save him this time and says, "Abandon truck. It's time to go." So we climb out the windows. He takes the canoe off of the top of the truck, sets it onto the road / river. We put the boys into it. We put whatever supplies we can in the back, and we start paddling up road. And we watch the truck go down behind us. So we're going up the rapids and paddling upstream. And we're going up and down and around. And we come to a high point where it's dry. And my dad decides this would be a good place to camp and have a little break. So we have a nice little view of our truck disappearing under the water as we make our hot chocolate and make sure everybody's well accounted for. And then we decide, no, we should go home. So we load into the canoe and go down road again. Finally, we come to dry land and we just leave the canoe. We leave all the supplies and we start to walk back to Fairbanks. By this time it's 10:30 p.m. or so. It's dark. There's nothing going on. And so we are walking down Chino Hot Springs Road with not a car in sight. Finally, we come up to one of the general stores. It's closed, but my dad decides I'm going to make a phone call. So he goes and pounds on the door, and light comes on. They open up, and he explains the situation, and they say, of course, you can call. The phone rings at home, and my mother, who has been giggling to herself all day and reading her mystery novels in her pajamas in bed, gets the call that, hi, honey. So we lost the truck and we need a ride. We're coming home. Love you. Bye. So my mom comes out and gets us. We all load into the car. It is a very quiet ride home. So we get home. Everybody collapses. A few days later, we head on out to try and salvage the truck, see what'll happen. So we get some friends, get a winch, and we go and we find the truck and we hook up to it and pull it out. They drain the fluids, they put new oil, they put new gas in. My dad drives it home and drives it for the next 10 years. And that's why I hate camping to this day. Thank you very much.
Those were a couple selections there from, as I've been saying, the Fairbanks version of Mudrooms, called Dark Winter Nights. We're going to rebroadcast that on New Year's Day in lieu of Alaska News Nightly, which won't be broadcast that night. So if you want to hear that full broadcast, I think there's another storyteller that'll play 6 p.m. on New Year's Day. Tomorrow on a Juno afternoon, Linda Rosenthal will be here to highlight Juno jazz and classics swing in the new year. We'll get an update from the crew at Eagle Crest. M.K. McNaughton will fill us in on her newest project, Grit. And we'll get the details about the New Year's Eve KXLL Block Party, that Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more Tuesday afternoon at 3 on KTOO News. The weather tonight, partly cloudy, lows 16 to 23. Coldest in wind-sheltered areas, light winds. Tuesday, increasing clouds, highs around 33. Light winds. Tuesday night, cloudy, chance of snow and rain late, lows 27 to 33, southeast winds 10 miles per hour. And going into Wednesday, rain, highs around 36, southeast wind 10 miles per hour.
This is nothing to worry about.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K201AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoona, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable, on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Stay tuned for All Things Considered coming up shortly.